I'm Tom Ashbrook from WBUR Boston. This is On Point. New U.S. Census data show that for the first time ever, adults living alone outnumber households of couples living with kids. Single-person households are now the most common type of household in America. From 1990 to 2000, the number of single-person households grew more than 21%. And for people ages 35 to 64, it grew a whopping 45%. This is not the traditional picture of American home life. So what's going on? Is married with children no longer the goal? Or is the Wall Street Journal right that we have a demographic bulge of lonely souls? This hour On Point, the causes and consequences of so many Americans now living on their own. We turn first to Washington to look at the latest demographic trends. William Fry is a research professor at the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan and visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. William Fry, thanks for being with us.
Well, it's good to be with you today, Tom.
How do you interpret these numbers? This is the 90 to 2000. This is the 2000 census, and we've got this big increase. Single households, now the most common kind of household. How do you interpret what's going on here?
Well, I think we still have the yet again another sort of reverberation of the baby boom. The baby boom has been affecting our demographics ever since it was born. The first baby boomer was born in 1946. And we know that the baby boomers, as they as they've gone through the life cycle, have delayed marriage, have had more divorces, and as we see for this age group that you talked about, the 35 to 64 age group, the baby boomers have taken center stage in that age group. They've grown into that age group between 1990 and 2000, and so all of their demographics are magnified, including living alone.
But what they've brought to the party then is a very non-traditional profile.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's some historical demographers will tell you that the Ozzie and Harriet family is not necessarily traditional if you go back decades and decades. But for most of us, baby boomers, I being one, look at our youth and look at our parents and look at our neighborhoods back in the 1950s. This certainly is a very different phenomenon than we were used to growing up in.
Now, for people to understand, when the Census Bureau looks at households, it categorizes households in many different ways. And specifically here, it's saying individual households, that is a household with a population of one, now for the first time make up more of American population than households that have a married or unmarried couple with children, the Ozzie and Harriet kind of view.
That's right. And, there are, dozens of different classes of households, if you want to think of, who the child is natural or he's adopted or if there are people living together. I mean, it's a whole profession in demography.
Just or extended families, a house with a grandmother under the roof and all the rest, all these different categories.
There are all kinds of classifications and combinations, and there's even one residual category that says all other. They couldn't even put those down after they put down the first 20 or so. I mean, the majority of households today are the three types we've been talking about: people living alone, married couples with children, and married couples without children. Those three types, comprise the modal types of households in the United States. It's what's news is that the single person household has now overtaken the Ozzie and Harriet household, which was dominant up until recently.
For the number one spot, and just by a fraction, but still it's head-turning. You raise a number of possible reasons for this, and I'd like to dive into them a little bit. I mean, 35 to 64 saw the biggest jump, and I'm looking at some even tighter statistics here showing that it's males, a bigger jump in men making up single-family households than women. 53% jump from 90 to 2000. The percentage of women, 38%. But what do you think is part of this? I mean, the boomers are aging. So is this partly driven by couples where one of the couples has died? Because divorce is down, I thought, over that decade.
Well, if we're looking at this 35 to 64 year old age group, there aren't that many people dying in those
right.
years. But it's I think a large part of divorce, and people still some part of the population is non-married, but the divorce part of it I think is important. And as I say, the baby boomers have a much higher prevalence of divorce. I mean, this is, I want to get into some arcane demographic stuff, but when you look at percentage change, what drives a lot of the high number and a high percentage change is whether there's a low base population at the beginning of the decade. And I think for the male baby boomer, the males, some of whom weren't baby boomers in 1990 that got that base, that was pretty small. And so when the baby boomers moved into that age group in the 90s, those male baby boomers look like a big percentage increase. But it is a big increase for males, and it means that the services that they need, the kinds of houses they need, and you know, a whole range of consumer items that can be tailored to these folks are going to be getting attention.
William Fry, we'll hear many women's voices in this hour, but let me ask you, what about women's independence, financial and otherwise, as driving this in no small part? I mean, that began before the 90s, but with the hot economy of the 90s, lots of job opportunities. Could it be that this is partly women not wanting or needing those men, and also finding their own independence, their own single life and lifestyle?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think the women's movement and women's economic independence is a large driver of this whole trend, and it's not just for the 90s. The fact that the baby boomers are who we're talking about here, the women's movement has had a very big impact on the baby boomers, on their marriage patterns, on the women's labor force participation patterns, on women's getting higher educations, more professional jobs, and all of that is embedded in these family changes that we're seeing in the 90s.
This trend has come with the boomers, but there are other trends. Lots of growth in the Hispanic population in the United States, a population that we associate with family life. Do you think that might turn this around? Will this pass with the boomers as well, William Fry?
Well, I think that we may see a bottoming out of the decline of the traditional family, and I've written about this elsewhere. I mean, if you go back to the 1950s, about half, almost half the families in the almost half the households in the United States were the Ozzie and Harriet families. Now it's less than a quarter, and so the big decline between the half down to the quarter really occurred in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and a little bit more in the 90s. What we've seen recently is this surge in single-person households, but the decline of the traditional family has been with us for a while and was much more severe two or three decades ago. And I think the Hispanic population moving into our demographic sort of collection is sort of bringing back a little bit more of the traditional family. So I don't think we're going to see a continued decline, maybe going from 50% to 25% to 12%. I mean, I think this 23% or whatever the traditional family is right now may go down a few percentage points, but the reason it won't decline much further is because of the Hispanics and maybe some Gen Xers and Gen Yers who grew up in broken households and maybe taking a family lifestyle a little more seriously than perhaps their parents.
But for now, the singles rule the demographics. William Fry, thanks a lot for painting the picture for us there.
Sure, I enjoyed it.
William Fry, research professor at the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. He spoke with me from Washington. We are talking this hour about new census data showing a huge increase in the number of Americans living alone. You can join the conversation. Are you part of the great American singles boom? By choice? By circumstance? And how do you see the causes and consequences of so many more Americans living at home alone? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Santa Barbara, California, is Bella DiPaolo. She is a social psychologist and visiting professor of psychology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Her forthcoming book, Singled Out, looks at the state of singles in America. Bella DiPaolo, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So here you're writing about singles, and out come the census numbers, and they confirm you've got the biggest demographic category in the country. Does this mean that singles are the kind of new face of America?
I think they certainly are part of the new face of America. And what you just described about the section of singles that's growing the fastest, namely the 35 to 64-year-olds, that's the section living alone growing fastest. That is really remarkable, I think, because typically when people try to explain the growing number of singles, and the number of singles has been growing for a while now, what they usually say is, well, people are putting off the age at which they first marry, which is true.
Right.
So they're getting more education or just not jumping into marriage as quickly. And on the other end, living longer, and when women outlive men, then they're going to be more single women.
It's inevitable. Mm-hmm.
Right. But this new increase in the middle is really interesting.
Does it mean that America is now single by choice in the middle of life?
That is surely a possibility. And isn't that really interesting when you think about all the glorification of marriage going on now with all the TV shows that end at the altar and the find a man bachelor type shows?
But we're talking the 90s here. That was Friends and Ally McBeal and Bridget Jones and Sex and the City.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was the single life that was getting the glory in those
years.
Yeah,
isn't that interesting? Because once the characters do get married, they're off the air.
The show's over.
What's interesting about that, right? So the interesting part is before they're married.
Well, we know you're the singles advocate, and we're going to come back and look a lot more at what's going on with Americans in their decisions to be alone in circumstances that leave them alone. Singles, now the largest single category of household in the United States, according to new analysis of census figures from the year 2000. Bella DiPaolo, author of the forthcoming Singled Out, please stick with us. We're talking about the booming single life. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are you part of the singles boom? Because you can be, because you want to be, because you have to be. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the booming single life. And for the first time in history, one-person households being the most common type of household in America. You can join the conversation. Why are more and more Americans living alone? Are you surprised to hear singles are now the most common type of household? Or do you see it all around you? Is the single life sexy? Is it lonely? What do these numbers tell you about where society is heading? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined from Santa Barbara, California, by Bella DiPaolo. Her forthcoming book is Singled Out. And right now from Portland, Oregon, by Sue Schellenberger. She's creator and writer of the Wall Street Journal's terrific Work and Family column. She's author of The Breaking Point, How Female Midlife Crisis is Transforming Today's Women. Sue Schellenberger, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure.
It's wonderful to have you. So here's an editorial from your paper, The Wall Street Journal, looking at these numbers, musing in many different directions, and then ask or suggesting at the end, maybe 27 million grown-ups living alone isn't so great for society. Is this a moment to make a judgment about whether it's good or bad, Sue? Is it just a fact of life? How do you look at it?
I see it as a fact of life, Tom. I think that it would be a mistake to rely on old stereotypes about what living alone really means. I think what we're seeing in the baby boom, as William Fry pointed out earlier, is an entire demographic phenomenon. And I think that midlife for boomers looks quite different than midlife did for people in the past. In a study I did of women, for example, for my recent book, many of the women saw midlife as a time of personal growth. They wanted to stay single. They chose to stay single following divorce. And they were really better armed in terms of skills, income, and confidence to remain single through midlife until they found the right relationship. So I think we're seeing a more dynamic state of singleness than we have in the past.
But, Sue, what about the very goal of a relationship, of singles wanting to become couples? Is that diminished as a goal because women don't need it financially because men can take their pants to the tailor to have them hemmed? I mean, do you see that just as falling away as a goal, as an ideal?
Well, certainly our definition of partnership has changed. Marriage has lost, to a large extent, its economic function as women become more independent. But paradoxically, I think it actually has more meaning to some people, and many of the women that I've studied and interviewed have told me that they really want more in a relationship. some of the women are looking for better relationships at midlife, and so they're staying single longer. And in other cases, they haven't found one good enough, and so they're not willing to settle anymore. Or perhaps their first relationship, which they left in divorce, wasn't as satisfying and left them wanting to be alone for a while. So I think we're redefining what it means to be single, and I think we're raising our ideals of what it means to be married, and that is indeed, I think, hazardous for the institution of marriage.
At the same time, of course, it's a market economy, and that economy is shaping itself around the demographic reality. I'm looking here at an economist from the National Association of Home Builders saying that they're finding unmarried people not looking at this as a transitional status anymore. They even want their homes built differently. They care less about privacy. They want fewer rooms. They want reduced, less square footage. They want more jacuzzis. They want to be close to the action, Bella DiPaolo, they're saying here. They don't care about school districts or space. They put a higher priority on being close to where the action is. In the marketplace, the writing here about, new watermelons. I've seen them in the stores. Little tiny watermelons, sort of the size for one individual serving containers at warehouse stores like Costco. But Sue's paper, Bella, says, even so, 27 million separate little cocoons is still disconcerting. Is it disconcerting, or is it just another way of being?
I don't think it's disconcerting at all. And one of the reasons is that, well, as Sue just said to you, our old notions and stereotypes of what it's like to be single are just not true. For example, what people say when they worry about the number of individuals living alone is that they're disconnected, or as the Wall Street Journal put it, a lonely bulge of, what was that quote?
A demographic bulge of lonely souls.
Yeah. And in fact, single people are often more connected than married people in the sense that they are not putting their entire interpersonal and emotional investment into just one stock, the soulmate stock.
So they're connected to more people, you're saying, over a wider range of relationships.
That's right. And people who stay single for a long time or maybe for a lifetime often tend more to the people they care about, their friendships or relatives or whatever those relationship categories may be, so that they are a more reliable friend. They're not putting their friends on the back burner while they do this soulmate thing. And I think another reason why it's not something to be concerned about is that because single people are not invested exclusively in, or almost exclusively in, just one person, they can think about issues in broader ways. So they're not concerned just about their neighborhood or their school district, but rather about, the nation's neighborhoods or the world's children. And I'm not saying all singles are like that. Of course they're not. But I think there is that potential to go beyond the very narrow, private way that some couples and families think about their own, each other and their own kids.
And about the world, there's a kind of a glowing, idealistic view of what's going on. And maybe it's true. On the other hand, we hear people saying they don't care as much about the school district, which is perhaps right underneath their noses. Sue, what about you write for the Wall Street Journal and the workplace? What about in the workplace? Are jobs, is the workplace encouraging singleness somehow? Can you feel the weight of this greater number of single Americans in the labor force?
Certainly we're seeing people more willing to change jobs at midlife. We're seeing greater fluidity and movement in the workforce, so I think we have a somewhat less stable workforce. We're seeing a rise in office romance. I mean, this is something that I've covered a fair amount in my column for the Wall Street Journal and get a huge response.
We've talked about it, and of course California had its big case on the ripple implications of office romance recently.
And how it spills onto coworkers.
Right.
This is a profound societal change. And so I've had, many messages from readers saying that the workplace played a role in the breakup of their marriage. So we are seeing increased transiency and kind of upheaval in the workforce. I think many employers, however, see a single worker as in some ways is a better worker. They assume they don't have a personal life, and so they can work long hours. This is an incorrect assumption.
Maybe an exploitable worker, maybe.
Exactly. Right. But it's still widespread.
I want to begin to bring our callers in. Desiree is calling from Moline, Illinois. Hi, Desiree. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're great. What do you think?
Well, I think it's been interesting listening to this discussion. And living in the heart of the Midwest, I may have a slightly different perspective. But out of all my friends, I'm the only one that's still single at 39. And quite frankly, I'm perfectly happy.
But do they think you should be happy? Or are you telling us they're putting the pressure on you to be other than single?
Actually, most of my married friends, say that they envy me and marriage is not all it's cracked up to be. Now, on the flip side, when I changed jobs about 5 years ago, some of my new colleagues, and a lot of them were in their 50s, would comment, "Boy, you're not married. What's wrong with you? You seem so nice."
But maybe it's a generational change. Are you saying then, Desiree, and this is complicated, but are you single by choice or are you, I don't know, still fishing? Maybe that's an old-fashioned idea. But
I would say I'm single by choice. I've had a couple opportunities to get married and partly wasn't ready, partly didn't think the guy was quite right. So I passed on those opportunities. And in hindsight, I do think I made the right decision.
Can you imagine yourself staying single right on through, or is that a forbidding idea?
Well, I tell you, there's pluses and minuses to either scenario. From my perspective, I could see pluses to getting married and building a life with another person. I could see pluses to staying single. And then there's negatives to either scenario as well.
But it's amazing to live in a time when it just seems like two options. It sounds like almost a toss-up. Desiree, thanks very much for your call from Moline. I want to turn to Los Angeles now, where we're joined by Megan Daum. She's essayist and novelist. Her op-ed piece, essay, Demography and the Single Girl, appeared in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times. Megan, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
You've got a great sense of humor and of the human condition, and we loved reading what you had to say about all this. What's your take on this surging bulge of singles in America?
Couple of different takes. I mean, I was surprised, like a lot of people, and as a single person and as a single householder myself, I found it sort of validating that we're actually in the largest category here. But I also found the news an interesting juxtaposition to this apparent obsession with couplehood in this country and wedding mania and the explosion of online dating and speed dating and matchmaking services. And it kind of got me thinking about the relationship between these two, sort of opposite planes here.
You had a funny take on this, saying that maybe people are single because marriage partners don't bring anything to the table anymore. Men used to know how to do certain things and women things. Now you say men my age don't know gutter cleaning from grout work. And a lot of women don't know how to clean a bathroom or hem a pair of pants. They don't need each other anymore.
Yeah, I mean, my tongue was in my cheek to some extent when
sure.
I was saying that. And, granted, I live in a major city and, circulate among people who don't tend to know a lot about hemming a pair of pants, myself included. But, I think it's really necessary to think about the economic ramifications of this issue. I mean, the fact is that this is a class issue, and there's a difference between being single as a something to talk about and being a single householder.
Now, what do you mean exactly?
Well, to live alone really requires either having abilities in a fairly renaissance way in terms of taking care of your house and taking care of your yard and earning the money to pay for it and all that stuff, or it requires being affluent enough to pay people to help you do certain things that, 20 years ago, I think people just sort of did for each other. That's what you relied on a spouse or a domestic partner for.
But surely there are many singles who are not affluent. I mean, it's not everybody who's bringing in hordes of yard workers and fancy tailors.
Well, I'm not talking about bringing in hordes of people, but I do think it's notable. It's not the most politically correct thing to talk about, but it seems undeniable that the wave of immigration from places like Latin America that we've seen in the last few decades has benefited single people. And you don't have to be wildly affluent to have somebody come and, you know, maybe do some dusting every couple of weeks.
So many, many ways of being single, but some of them being underwritten by other demographic changes. Megan, stand by. I want to take a call from Keisha in Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Keisha. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
We're well. What do you think? What do
Good.
You see?
I actually agree a lot with the first caller. I'm 40, and I have been single my whole life. And I'm also African-American.
Okay.
And there's this whole conversation that's been going on since I was an undergrad, really, about, you know, the relationships between black men and women and the number of, you know, professional black women versus number of professional black men.
Right.
And all the different, you know, dynamics that are involved there. As of right now, I am single by choice. I have been able to, I was a professional in Chicago, and then I picked up, decided to go back to school, which is why I'm here in Iowa City.
Yeah.
And I'm not really looking for anybody right now, yet there are people who, again, you know, from the black perspective,
yeah.
from, you know, some of the people I know,
yeah.
who kind of see me as, I sometimes feel they see me as somebody to be pitied. You know,
but yet there's a strong tradition, or at least what feels like a new tradition, I guess, of professional black women kind of in the same place. Sure, we had Terry McMillan on just a couple of weeks ago, of course, the African-American novelist, and she's writing lately about a marriage that she didn't much like in her latest novel. Are you saying that black women of a certain standing are choosing this? And
I think some of us are. I think some of us are, you know, still trying to get, you know, do the thing with, you know, trying to find out where the action is. And I think some of us have really specific standards. There's many different ways to look at it. There are some of us who are really determined not to settle for just anybody, you know. And
Keisha,
I think, and there's also this idea of scarcity, which I got to be honest,
right.
I don't really believe in.
Mm-hmm.
There's this idea of scarcity amongst eligible black men. And again, there's lots of, you know, material on this. But
right.
I think in my case, I'm just living my life. And I'm happy I was able to, you know, being single allowed me to be able to make this recent, you know, life change that I did by going back to school.
There's a lot of freedom implicit in that. Let me ask you, Keisha, within your cultural corner of the world, do you feel like you could go ahead another 10 or 20 years single and still, you know, be able to hold your head up and be accepted by your the folks you're socializing with, the people you care about?
I think I can, yeah. I think, I said, I got a couple older relatives who are just kind of scratching their heads right now.
What's up with Keisha?
You know, they're like, what's going on with her?
Right,
but
right.
Yeah, I now granted, you know, as the woman before said, you know, there are pluses and minuses to this life, and there are times when I would like to have somebody along to walk, you know, alongside me, but right now, I'm too busy living my life. I'm not really searching. So, yeah, 10, 20 years, it's entirely possible, and it doesn't scare me.
It's an amazing picture, kind of a new vista, Keisha. We thank you for calling in with it from Iowa City. Megan Daum, what about the, I mean, you talk some about the society's obsession, I think was your word, with couples and married life, but we had very high-profile things in the media in the 90s and recent years celebrating the single life. Do you think that's part of what's pushing this here?
Yeah, and I think Keisha makes a great point. And, you know, the situation in the African-American community is a great example, and it really puts into sharp relief what's happening, across a lot of communities in America, which is where, you know, educated women are under tremendous pressure to find men who are equally, if not more so, educated. And the fact is that when you look at the numbers, there are more women going to college and getting advanced degrees than there are men at this point. So it really it puts us in a kind of a tough position sometimes. I mean, if we're going to have this pressure to get married and be in couples, you know, there's also a pressure to, quote-unquote, marry well.
Right.
And when the numbers just don't make that possible, you're left with being single. And I think it's great that it's become not only accepted, but in some ways preferable.
Bella DiPaolo, people finding the status that they want within that singledom?
It's a mixed thing, and I think that quote from the Wall Street Journal about, you know, that demographic bulge of lonely souls is a great example of what I think of as singleism, which is a kind of stereotyping and caricaturing and putting down of people who are single.
Give it up, you say, because they are the new number one category. Bella DiPaolo, author of the forthcoming Singled Out, thanks very much for being with us. We're talking this hour about the booming single life. We'll be right back with more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the booming single life, and for the first time, one-person households being the most common in America. You can join us. What do you think? Is this newfound independence among adults? Is it modern isolation? Is it something else? Are we weaving a new social fabric or tearing the old one apart? Is the singles boom at bottom a story of female empowerment or something else? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined this hour by Sue Schellenbarger. She's creator and writer of the Wall Street Journal's Work and Family column, author of The Breaking Point, How Female Midlife Crisis is Transforming Today's Women. And from Los Angeles, we're joined by Megan Daum, essayist and novelist. Her op-ed was in Tuesday's LA Times, Demography and the Single Girl. Right now, Eric is calling from Boston. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're good. What do you think of all this, Eric?
Well, I'm 30 and I'm single, and I'm, you know, as you say, happy and content with being single, but I believe that attitude is a creation out of necessity, that if you're single, any single person, if given the option between being single and finding love, would take love.
Okay, there's something we'll hear more on. Are you so sure when you talk to your friends, the guys, the gals, they all share that?
Yes. I am. The only problem is there's, you know, why relationships aren't working is another question that I really can't answer on. All I know is that if you want to compare being single to having a bad relationship, yeah, of course, you're going to want to be single. But if anyone had the option of finding that true love or that real companionship that is fulfilling and satisfying, you'd take that over being single any day of the week.
And when you heard Bella DiPaolo say, oh, you know, singles have a much wider range of kinds of relationships, they're not just tied down in one, what's your response to that?
It's a creation of necessity. You know, as I said, I'm single, I'm happy, I'm content with it, but I need to be happy and content with it in order to put one foot in front of the other and keep moving through day to day.
Sounds like you are eager to jump off that demographic lily pad. And we've got it, Eric. Thanks very much for your call. Sue, how about it? Eric looks at it as definitely a second choice, almost a pathology, a creation of necessity. Do you think he's in the mainstream with that?
I think he's definitely in the mainstream. And I think, you know, the dark side that we haven't talked about too much here is that as marriage has lost its economic function, we no longer need each other to survive. We're looking very hard at the romantic Western notion of romantic love as sustaining us, and it's falling short. We don't really know how to form good and lasting relationships by and large, and we're lacking in the many cases in the spiritual basis for a good relationship. So I think that Eric makes a very good point for a big subset, if not a majority, of the single population. We yearn for that relationship, and we're ambivalent about it because maybe we've never experienced it.
Megan Daum, how about it? Are we celebrating something here because we have to? I mean, Eric's suggesting that something is going on in society. I think I hear him saying that's making it perhaps more difficult to form relationships. Sue Schellenberger put some economic arguments, even spiritual arguments out there for that. Do you see it that way?
Well, people have very high expectations for relationships. I mean, I kind of I joke sometimes that it's not a relationship that we find ourselves in, but it's an expectation ship.
Meaning?
I'm sorry?
Meaning that
you've
got a laundry list of I need and want this and that.
I think it's true. It's like, you know, we really have ideas about relationships that are rooted in romance. and even the soulmate idea, you know, it's nice and it's a good thing to aspire to, but the fact is that that's incredibly rare to find a soulmate in anybody, and much less in somebody that, you know, you're physically, romantically, and, you know, involved with. So I think that, you know, because we really don't need each other in the same ways economically, and we don't, you know, women aren't reliant upon men to buy property and you know, increasingly to even have babies, you know, we sort of go into this kind of fairy tale world. And I even wonder if on some level part of the wedding craze and, you know, speed dating and matchmaking, all this stuff has to do with a sort of unconscious awareness that the whole institution of marriage is going to be temporary for many people.
Wow. So expectations higher, economic need for that union less, and maybe a gap opening in between. And I hear people not quite sure whether they're celebrating that, you know, sort of a single pride or simply dealing with that. Let's take another call. Nancy's calling from Wilmington, Delaware. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that as a pastor, I see and speak to a lot of singles who come into my congregation, and I see really both sides of what your guests have been talking about. I see people who are very independent. They have very high standards, and they're happy with their single lives. They like having their own home and have as much of an active life as they seem capable of having, whether they were married or single. And then the other side, I see a lot of people, especially in their early 30s to early 40s, who feel really desperate to be married, that they're running out of time, yet they don't know how to meet other people. They're limited in their contact with the other people that they work with and so on. And part of what I do is help them to find new routes. And one of the routes I encourage is online. I think that's replacing the college atmosphere or the bar atmosphere that people relied on in earlier times.
But let me ask you, Nancy, you're a pastor. Your job is partly to look into people's hearts and souls and figure out how to help them. Are you comfortable with the idea or embracing of the idea that singleness is just fine? You don't need a partner economically. Maybe you don't need one at all. Or do you see that somehow at odds with what humans are as spiritual beings?
Well, I think that you have to really look deep within and decide what matters the most to you. And I think there are a great many people who are perfectly happy single and think they would probably be giving up something significant spiritually to marry just for the sake of pleasing family or friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we did more of that in past years. I know, you know, I'm now almost 60. I certainly think my generation felt we had to get married.
Right, and often paid for that in relationships that weren't anything like ideal.
Precisely.
Nancy, thanks very much for your call. Megan Daum, you point out that it is certainly not just women who are riding this single trend, and the kind of, whether it's the sexiness or the stigma of singleness is now also attaching to single men of a certain age.
Yeah, although I've noticed that it manifests quite differently. I mean, you know, it was interesting to me with all this hype about the 40-year-old virgin.
The new movie.
That's come out, I guess it opened last Friday. You know, for a long time, the sort of the single woman has been this kind of a pathetic, mythical figure who, you know, sat in bed and gorged on Haagen-Dazs and, you know, the sort of Miss Lonely Hearts prototype.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the last maybe, you know, 10 or so years, we've really seen a change. I mean, we had, you know, the equally fairy tale-like qualities of the Sex and the City women, not totally realistic, but also certainly not pathetic in the traditional ways. And what we have instead are men who are sort of, you know, we see them, you know, sitting around in their bathrobes and unshaven and being kind of depressed about being single, where the women are out there more. So, you know, obviously these are just media images that we're being sold, but, you know, they are a reflection of something.
And men then not sure whether it's okay or not. You have them saying, you know, sitting around as bachelors collecting action figures. That suggests a kind of perpetual childhood association with singleness among men of that age.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. There is, according to the National Association of Realtors, women, in terms of being home buyers, are the second largest category of you know, first-time home buyers.
Digging right into the whole life, just making it work.
Absolutely, as opposed to single men. And I would really be curious, you know, of this study about householders in general, if there are more women living alone than men living alone, if men tend to live, you know, with their parents like they do in Italy and other places in Europe.
Right.
Or if they, you know, have roommates. I don't know. I'd be very curious.
Well, the growth was a little greater among men, but I don't know the absolute number answer to that. Let's take another call. William's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, listen, I was wondering what might be the long-term effects of this sociologically. I wonder if we're going to be as empathetic, as understanding, as compassionate with a large group of singles, people who might be self-focused, self-indulgent, maybe self-absorbed.
Oh, it's an interesting question. Sue Schellenberger, what's your response?
William, that's a great question. I think it's very, very important. I think learning how to make sacrifices for other people and learning how to live communally in some senses are very important to society. And I also think that as this demographic group ages, that we're going to have to either see some radical innovation as we get into old age and we need care from each other, or we're going to see really what will, I think, indeed be a sad picture of many old singletons out there struggling, trying to live on their own.
I've seen news stories just in the last couple of days about how hard it can be for singles when they get into a less firm age of health, when they could use an extra pair of hands around the house.
Oh, very much so. Probably 80% of the long-term care in this country is now provided by family members, and my personal bet is that 65% of that is by spouses. What's going to happen to those tens of millions of old folks when they have no spouse at hand?
Megan, what about this William's question of the capacity for empathy, tendency towards self-absorption? Are those stereotypical ways of looking at the single, or real issues for the country sociologically?
Yeah, you know, it kind of reminds me of the arguments people make a lot of the time about childless people. You know, there's always this attachment of the word selfish, you know, to people who choose not to have children.
And, why aren't you reproducing?
Yeah, and then, you know, on the other side of it, it's like, you know, the child-free community says, oh, well, you know, people who have children are selfish. And, you know, I think I might have to start calling all of these arguments the jacuzzi problem, because, you know, this assumption that single people don't care about school districts because they want to have a jacuzzi in their house, that seems to me like an incredibly broad stroke. And, you know, I do think, obviously, there are certain economic realities in terms of aging and the population and you know, what are these people going to do
right
without spouses? But it's very, very... it's quite a generalization to say that single people don't care about their community. You have a lot of people getting involved with churches, for instance, with all sorts of volunteer work. So we got to be really careful about those assumptions.
You know what they say about travel, that you're never more connected to where you're traveling than when you're traveling alone. There are certainly circumstances in which singleness can make a person more open to what's going on around them, not less. Bill's calling from Lexington, South Carolina. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm 64 years old. I'm a professional.
Mm-hmm.
My wife died about 6 years ago. It cost me about $500,000.
In health costs at the end,
yeah.
Bill?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, insurance doesn't pay what they're supposed to. And I mean, the medical, you know, we're supporting the medical people, I guess. But what I'm looking at is I have children.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like my grandchildren to be able to go to better colleges, so I'd like to help my children make that possible. The taxes are higher, the cost of living is much higher. So I'm single, and I'm thinking, do I want to marry somebody else's widow, probably, and end up paying another $500,000 for her to die?
I mean, at your age, taking on the responsibility of a partner again?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a very pragmatic person, and I'm considered to be somewhat of a Renaissance
man.
Sounds
like pragmatism. I hear that, yeah. So,
I mean, I'm looking at it. I have responsibilities to my children to help them have a better stand, you know, help them. I look at what it costs me to send them to college, and I'm looking at what it's costing to send my grandchildren to college. I mean, it's absolutely preposterous.
And marriage or remarriage doesn't add up, but do you feel like you're losing something with that cool calculation, Bill?
I had a great marriage. I bought into that, you know, in sickness and in health, and for better or for worse, I'm responsible. You know, I have a responsibility to my children and my grandchildren. My brother died about 12 years ago. He didn't do very well. I helped my sister-in-law, who just died a few weeks ago. I mean,
A lot of angles to figure here.
For all that.
And we hear it. Bill, I want to put that to my guest, and thank you for your call, Megan Daum. There is a kind of 64-year-old cool calculation, realism from the single front about financial issues at a certain age, as Bill's calculating it.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, you know, his heart is in a really great place, and he's done a lot for people, and I sympathize with his position. I mean, I guess my question would be, why does he need to get married? You know, it's not necessary. And I'm very far from his circumstances, so I don't want to speak for him at all, but my wonder would be, you know, why he needs to get married. He could be in a relationship and sort of stay independent, at least in a legal sense. I mean, there's all sorts of ways to live in the world and to be with others rather than getting married.
We're clearly hearing that in this hour. We've just got a couple minutes left. Sue, where do you think this is headed? We heard at the top of the hour from William Fry, demographer, saying, well, you know, maybe as the boomer bulge passes and we have a larger Hispanic population, a family-oriented population, maybe this will be a moment in time like Ally McBeal was a nano moment in time.
I think we'll see a lot of learning going on. As the boomers age, I think they'll come up with innovative ways to be together, some of which Megan has kind of talked about, and the different kinds of relationships that come up and that and Bill mentioned. I think we'll see Gen X learning from us, taking a look. Do we want to be living alone at midlife? And I think we may see some non-marriage alternatives emerging that will give us the opportunity to form deep relationships without the economic and legal entanglements that marriage represents, because I don't think we can really hope that life is going to get simpler.
And Megan, you're looking out as a single person here, so what's the stirring in your heart? Are you thinking, this is the path I'm on and I like it and I'm going to stay on it? Are you open?
You know, I've always been the sort of person who, you know, I enjoy being in relationships a lot of the time, and I would like to be in one, but I don't need to be in one, and it's an important distinction, and I think that it's one that a lot of people my generation make, and you know, we'll see. I think it's entirely possible. I could remain single for the rest of my life, and some days that seems like an okay thing, and other days it seems sort of bizarre and you know, possibly not so great. But you know, it's
yep. That's life.
Go either way.
So there's the state of the new American household. Wouldn't mind sharing a partner in it, but don't need to. And a whole new picture emerging. Megan Daum in L.A., essayist and novelist there. Thank you very much for being with us this hour. It's been great having you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
And Sue Schellenberger with her terrific work and family column in The Wall Street Journal, author of The Breaking Point. Sue, it's wonderful to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, James Ross, Christina Rousseau, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.